Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can animals teach us better ways to live our own lives? The creatures of the earth that have survived for billions of years are still with us in part because they've evolved some brilliant strategies for staying alive in an unpredictable world, from clever ways to catch prey or escape predators to the development of mutually beneficial relationships with other species. And my guest today believes we humans could greatly benefit from applying similar approaches to our biggest problems. Rafe Sagarin is a marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst at the University of Arizona. His new book is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. Rafe, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So at first glance, observational ecology and national security seem to be strange bedfellows. Can you tell us about how the relationship began to take shape for you?
Yeah, of course. I always say that adaptation is about leaving or being forced from your comfort zone. And my comfort zone was just studying the tide pool organisms of the Pacific coast, but I found myself less than a year after 9/11 serving as a science advisor to U.S. Congresswoman and now Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, and it would be impossible not to be an observer of the world in D.C. in 2002 and 2003 and not see this massive new security environment arising everywhere. But from my perspective as a biologist, I became increasingly concerned that all this new security was coming up, and then unlike the tide pools that I study, which change every single day, this security environment wasn't changing at all. And that led me to think, how would adaptable enemies get around these kind of security efforts? And that led me to ask questions about, well, exactly how does adaptability work in nature and what can we learn from it?
Yeah, so what we did essentially after 9/11 was prepare ourselves for an attack exactly like the one we had just endured.
Yeah, and we continue to do that kind of thing. When someone tries to blow up an airliner with a shoe bomb, then we start checking people's shoes. And when we learn about a terrorist plot using liquid explosives, then we start banning liquid. So, of course, the next terrorist attack attempts to use a dehydrated explosive, which would be rehydrated on board.
Yeah, so no matter how quickly we move or we think we move, changing an entire system doesn't allow us to be as nimble as our enemies.
Not if we're focused on one particular thing that we're trying to predict what's going to happen, because we live just like all these organisms that have survived for 3.5 billion years in an unpredictable and risk-filled world. And yet organisms in nature have survived and thrived without planning, without predicting, and without trying to come up with the perfect solution to the problem.
Yeah, let's talk about the octopus, which is sort of the cover, the poster child of this book, but not the only animal. This is a remarkable creature that has a whole host of pretty minor defense strategies, but taken together, they make it almost invincible in a lot of situations.
Yeah, well, the octopus has this beautiful combination of many different ways to see change in the world and many different ways to respond to change in the world. And the most important thing that it shares with many other biological systems is a decentralized organization where it does, in fact, have a good centralized brain, which is very useful for it. It's quite a remarkable brain. But it doesn't use that brain to say, as it's going over a coral reef, arm one turned blue, and arm two turned purple, and arm three turned bluish-purple. Rather, it lets all its individual skin cells spread out across its body individually respond to the colors and shapes that they're perceiving on the coral reef, and thus giving the octopus as a whole this camouflaged ability. So that's one way it uses multiple sensors to see change in the world. But then in addition to camouflage, it can also jet away in a cloud of ink. It can squeeze itself into a tiny little crevice. And it can use that clever mind it has to say, create a suit of armor out of a couple discarded coconut shells.
And the other thing that, about the octopus is that it has a symbiotic relationship, at least certain species of octopus have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria.
Yeah, well, that's just an illustration of a general biological principle, which is that all organisms reach the limits of their own adaptability. And if they want to stretch further and adapt further, they need to create some kind of partnership with another organism. And this kind of symbiotic partnerships are everywhere in nature, and they occur between the most unlikely of pairs of organisms, including organisms that previously had an antagonistic relationship. We need to be much more active about finding those points where we can form symbiotic partnerships even with our enemies.
Yeah, so if everybody benefits, it makes sense to create these partnerships.
Even if one party benefits just a tiny bit and the other party benefits a lot, as long as both parties are a little better off, it's worth doing it. And a wonderful example of this comes from a very unlikely place, which is Palestinian territories in Israel and Jordan. There are health ministers from all three of those places working together with doctors to identify and neutralize the threat of emerging infectious diseases, which, of course, don't care what side of the border wall they appear on, but will affect everyone. And so by focusing on the immediate problem, these doctors are not focusing on the issue of peace in the Middle East, the perfect solution. They're just focusing on the problem they all face right away. Now, these partnerships are so effective, they may eventually be a stepping stone to peace in the Middle East. But for right now, the point is, how do we solve this problem, which is far more important than any of our political problems?
And by empowering those people who are far lower down in their respective governments and societies, you bypass the problem of the top echelons really not being able to get along.
Yeah, because there's all these sort of political ideals that they have to deal with at those highest levels. But when you get down to the level of people who are working to solve problems, they don't care about all that set dressing. They just want to solve the problem. And that's why they're more like natural organisms, which don't bother themselves with what the biologist Ed Ricketts called worded idealisms. They are what they are, he said. And that's how they solve problems. And the more we can act like that, the better we're going to be at adaptively solving problems.
Why do you think, Rafe, that we tend to believe we are so far above nature that we don't have anything to learn from it?
Well, because we've been so spectacularly successful with our adaptable capabilities, and our abilities to work together is unparalleled in terms of developing new technologies and all these kind of things. But the flip side of that is that we've insulated ourselves from the power that produces evolutionary responses. And so my book is trying to get us to recognize that and where that damages us by being insulated, and then sort of reopen our adaptable capabilities.
So ultimately, evolution wants us to survive long enough to reproduce. And what's interesting about that is that evolution does not have the capacity to go back and try again with failed adaptations. It is only the successes that go on.
Yeah, exactly. We're hearing a lot in the business literature and management consultants who sort of cleverly tell us to learn from failure and then acknowledge your failures and learn from them. And we actually do way too much learning from failure. Learning from failure in evolution means you die or you don't reproduce. And yet every living organism on Earth is an example of its ancestors learning from success. By definition, those ancestors were successful in reproducing their genes, and that success gives you a basis to build more success into the future and to grow, or, you know, recursively better and better adaptations. We don't spend enough time doing that. An example is after Hurricane Katrina, which had many failures. It's important to acknowledge those failures, especially the dumb ones that you don't want to repeat. But our after-action report from the government for Katrina listed over 100 failures that we were supposed to learn from, and yet it completely ignored one of the critical successes, which was a Coast Guard containing a massive 8 million gallon oil spill Now, when would that lesson be useful? Hmm. Actually, in the very next Gulf disaster, which was the Deepwater Horizon disaster.
And so the Coast Guard didn't play a major role in Deepwater Horizon?
They did play a major role, but there's so much focus on the learning from failure coming out of Katrina is that you didn't have a lot of focus on what worked right. And there are actually a number of successes in Katrina, and they tended to be when individuals and small agencies were recognizing if they didn't bother with the standard operating procedure and all that, but they just tried to solve the problem as it occurred, they could do something. For example, the Maritime Service, which normally transports material and equipment overseas, realized, oh, wait, we have a bunch of floating objects here, all our barges and ships that are enlisted with the Maritime Service, we could use them as mobile command centers for all these agencies that can't really operate on land right now. So there was a spontaneous response that was quite adaptive.
And once again, our enemies are able to, whether they intend to or not, they do benefit from the idea of learning from success to the extent that people who, say, plant IEDs, if they're not very good at it, they blow themselves up along the way. But if they are, they survive to cause more chaos.
Yeah, and this is one of the grim realities of the kind of world and the kind of warfare we're living with now is that with our superior firepower and arms, we tend to kill off many more insurgents than we suffer casualties ourselves, and yet it's been shown that we get no better at competing against the insurgency overall through time, and it's because we're actually a selective force that ends up leaving the strongest insurgents, the most clever insurgents around to teach others what works. Against a strong force. It's just like when we apply broad-spectrum pesticides or broad-spectrum antibiotics against these very adaptable bugs. The strongest of those bugs, the most resistant, survive and reproduce, and now we have Roundup-resistant weeds. Now we have multiple resistant bugs to almost all antibiotics.
So how do we find the right balance between sort of blanketing ourselves with defenses that might work on a variety of different levels and overkill that actually strengthens those that we want to weaken?
Yeah, and it's important that you mention balance because it is about finding a balance. And the balance is tipped right now far too much on the side of centralized organizations, on the side of small groups of experts telling everyone else what to do and often coming up with the wrong solution in the process. And the way we kickstart this process that starts to rebalance us and get us to become more naturally adaptable again is we switch from that small group of experts giving orders to a mode of issuing challenges. That's when we say, here's a problem we're facing. Who among all of you can help us solve this problem? And every time an organization has switched to that mode and started issuing challenges, it doesn't matter how centralized or old-fashioned this organization is, if they start to issue challenges, they get all those attributes of natural adaptive systems coming back in return. They get multiple observers of the problem from many different perspectives who are coming up with multiple different ways to solve the problem. And they end up getting solutions much more quickly, much more effective solutions, and much, much more cheaply than they would if they simply kept on with going to a single person to come up with the right solution or a single contractor to come up with the right solution.
My guest is Rafe Sagarin. He's a marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst at the University of Arizona. His new book is called Learning from the Octopus: How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst at the University of Arizona, Rafe Sagarin. His new book is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call in. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Another really interesting parallel between human society and nature, Rafe, is this idea of interconnected systems. So that in nature, you might have particular ecosystems or the food chain. When they work well, they work brilliantly. And then when one part of them is threatened, the whole thing threatens to collapse. And it's the same with our networked information systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Networks can be a great source of adaptability, but they can also be vulnerable, especially if they rely extensively on major hubs. So if my personal website goes down, no big deal to the network, and that's one of the nice things about networks. If Google goes down, we all have a big problem because we've come to rely on it quite extensively.
So how do we make sure that in building redundant defenses into our systems that we do that the right way?
Well, again, it's about not relying so much on experts or leaders who think they know the answer and want to predict the right answer, but really getting at those individuals and organizations that are out there right where change is happening. So, for example, we've got this amazing generation of young officers and NCOs coming back from 10 years of conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, and some of them are among the most adaptable people we've ever seen. And the challenge for us here is to welcome these people back and not quash these adaptable skills that they've developed, but actually learn from them because they had this opportunity to and were essentially forced into a new niche where they really had to learn how to survive.
And no doubt among those survival skills that they picked up is communication, not simply with their own teams, but also in whatever form with those they're fighting.
Exactly. So the first thing was being really good observers of change going on in your world, and you can't help it if you're being shot at or bombed. And so right from the early days of the Iraq conflict, well before the Department of Defense back in Washington knew that their planned form of attack and their predicted conflict was completely different, those soldiers on the ground recognized that improvised explosive devices, IEDs, were the biggest threat to their security. It took over 3 years for the Department of Defense, through its contracting process, to get up-armored vehicles in country there. So in the meantime, these guys had to survive, and one of the most important things they did is create, again, symbiotic partnerships, in this case with even people who might have previously been shooting at them, and that helped them identify through tips who the bombers were, where the bombs were being put out, and that greatly reduced the IED deaths they were experiencing well before the up-armored vehicles came into that theater.
And in terms of nature, we've seen examples of this even in cross-species communication. Animals find ways of letting each other know what's going on and what to expect.
Yeah, one of the most remarkable things comes from a fairly unremarkable animal, the ground squirrel. So we've recently learned that ground squirrels speak to their predators in the predator's own language. So if a ground squirrel sees a hawk or a coyote around, it'll make a loud alarm call. And what that call does is it tells that predator, I know you're there. You cannot sneak up on me. Your uncertainty advantage is gone, so don't even bother trying to attack me. But it won't make an alarm call if it sees a snake. A snake doesn't hear, so an alarm call wouldn't do it any good. What it does is it puffs up its tail and waves it around, so it signals to the snake. And if, and only if, that snake is a rattlesnake, the squirrel will also heat up its tail because rattlesnakes see in infrared. So these are messages tailored to the individual predator using the predator's own perception and language.
So how could we talk better to our predators? Let's just take the example of airport security. Instead of, you know, putting that blanket code orange or whatever, which has finally been eliminated, what do we do to tell them, hey, we're on to you? Don't bother.
Well, again, one of the things is we find out where there is a mutual need, for example, which is what the soldiers in Iraq did. They realized no matter what they did in terms of armor or whatever, the enemy would adapt, so they had to find informational ways of getting to that. The other thing we can do is not project exactly what we're looking for, as we do when we say, you can't take more than 3 ounces of a liquid on board, which basically says to our adversary, okay, I'll take a dehydrated explosive on board and rehydrate it on board, which is exactly what the underwear bomber tried to do. So some of the layers of security that we don't see are the most important layers, like behavioral screening, which is being done at many airports around the country. That's something that predators or our adversaries can't see because it can be done from behind the scenes. It can be done in a very casual manner. When TSA agents come up to talk to you in the airport, they're not just making small talk. They are screening you, and they're looking at your behaviors. And the reason it works is because humans have, for all our evolutionary existence, needed to have a very clear sense of the behavioral intent of other humans, because for most of our existence, we lived in very small groups where that behavioral intent was desperately needed to be known. And this means that identifying behavioral signs of agitation, of concealing something, is something that we're very, very good at.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First on the line, we have Chris in Irving. Hi, Chris.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
As I listen to your guest, whose name I unfortunately didn't hear.
Rafe Sagarin.
Thank you. So I want to read your stuff. Puts me very much in mind of three kind of systems thinkers that I've been known to work with. One is a Professor John Seddon out of the UK, who really is sort of hot on command and control and anti-command and control as being what he calls deliverology, and the way of the more you measure, actually the worse you do. The second is Daniel Pink and his work on extrinsic motivation. So we actually don't necessarily do what we're motivated to do by external forces, but by things that drive us from the inside. So, you know, don't give me a salary raise, give me more interesting work. Yeah. And then thirdly, a guy called David Snowden, who worked, among others, with Secretary Rumsfeld on something that he refers to as the Kinefin framework, and the whole notion of sort of complex adaptive systems. And I'm wondering if the work that you're doing and you're talking about fits into the sorts of sets of thinking I'm describing here.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think those are three very important concepts, and they're sort of tied together in a practical sense in this idea I'm putting forth, that if we want to be more like these decentralized, adaptable systems like the octopus, we sort of have to kickstart it, and the way we kickstart it is by shifting from small groups of so-called experts issuing orders that everyone's expected to follow to issuing challenges that anyone can respond to. And a good example, which I think ties in your motivational thing, is 3M, a company which is not an adaptable company by nature. It's not built up as an adaptable system like, say, Google was. But it's a company that wanted to reduce its environmental footprint, and rather than have the CEO send a stern memo to everyone saying everyone must recycle 20% more, they issued a challenge to anyone in the company to come up with ways to reduce the environmental footprint. So you had the administrative assistant saying, oh, well, we could reduce paper if we just did this, and chemists saying, we could reduce chemical pollution if we just did this. And collectively, these ideas, there were over 8,000 ideas that were accepted, saved the company millions of dollars and greatly reduced its environmental footprint, and there was very little needed in terms of motivation. I think respondents essentially got a certificate of recognition because people essentially want to solve problems. If they're on board with, say, the mission of the company, they want to solve problems.
What goes wrong, do you think, Rafe, when you know, we start at the top and do best practices and then try to apply those universally?
Well, it's the exact opposite of what nature does. Nature doesn't plan, nature doesn't predict, and it doesn't try to perfect itself. And yet, when we're looking afar at a problem and we're disconnected from it, we want to do something. So we say, well, we could map this out. We could define best practices, optimal solutions. We can optimize this system instead of just thinking about what is the immediate problem and how do I solve that problem.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Paul in Garland. Hello, Paul.
Hey, hi. Hey, Rafe. Are there new sensibilities that we are going to have to ascribe to, like the sensibility of the pilot fish or sensibility of schools of fishes or the sensibility of the octopus for us to survive as a species?
I don't think so. I think we need to a little shift, and sometimes it does take a little bit of a jump, but I'm not saying we have to evolve into a whole new species. We're a really good adaptable species. We've done really well. We just need to kickstart a little bit our adaptable capabilities, and I'll give you one example. I'm a professor at a university, and I teach college students, and the standard model is that you develop a syllabus for the whole semester, you give it to the students, and that's what you're going to learn all semester long. And I realized that the organization of my class is not unlike the organization of the Department of Homeland Security, which I mocked in my talks. So now, over the last several years, what I've started to do, and it took a little shift on my part, I said, you know what? My students are smart. They'll be motivated much more so if they get to learn what they want to learn about this topic. So the very first day of class, I take the syllabus in. My dean requires me to have a syllabus, but I rip it up. And I say, what is it that you guys want to learn about this topic? And what can you share with the class about this topic from your own experiences? And what we get is every single day, students are putting into the class much more so than if I just told them exactly what they're going to learn from my, if I'm honest, very limited set of knowledge. So that's just one example in personal life how you can make that shift. And anyone in any part of any organization, no matter how bureaucratic it is, can start to make this shift by issuing challenges to people to help them solve problems.
What's interesting about that example, Rafe, is that I think bureaucracies have an inherent belief that individuals can't be trusted to actually make any effort. In other words, if students are given a choice, a lot of bureaucratic systems would assume that they're not going to choose to work very hard.
Yeah, and what I find again and again and again is the incentives to get people to get involved in this challenge-based problem solving are far, far lower than anyone would imagine. That's why when DARPA, a branch of the DOD, issues a challenge to anyone to solve one of their problems for $1 million prize, which is nothing to the DOD, there are engineering departments all over, colleges all over the country racing to solve this problem, even spending way more than the $1 million prize to try to solve it, because their motivation is to show off how great their engineering department is. And you get solutions to the problem much more quickly, more effective, and much cheaper than you would with the typical hire a single mega defense contractor and wait 20 years and spend billions of dollars more than the contract was for to get something that doesn't do what it was set out to do in the first place.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Back to the phone now. We have Robert on the line in Dallas. Hey, Robert.
Hi, this has been just a fantastic conversation, by the way. I appreciate you having it. My comment slash kind of question is, how does the author kind of see his perspective in a political arena? I mean, I've been listening on the radio for the last 30 minutes or so, and it seems like he sounds like a very staunch Tea Party Republican, that it's a very small government, decentralized, let the people make their choices for where they live, for their specific problems. And I kind of want to see how he would describe that.
Yeah, well, if I'm being honest, I'm not a Tea Party Republican. But what I'm concerned about is not so much how much government, this or that, but the organization you use. There is still a very important role for the centralized organization. All those skin cells in the octopus aren't floating around amiss. When we issue good challenges, we don't say, everyone go out and do something really cool. Okay, just be totally independent and do something really cool. So there's a role for a central organization to provide resources to a challenge, to identify what that challenge is. And it's not just governments that fall into this trap of becoming too centralized and too state in what they do. Corporations almost do it more so because they have very little outside feedback mechanism. As flawed as our democracy is, there's still a feedback system there. But corporations can go on doing very unadaptable things without much feedback. Often, sometimes the biggest corporations do that because they get huge contracts that sort of allow them a lot of waste. And what we see in nature is that adaptability can happen with very few resources. It almost has to happen with very few resources. So I think what is appealing about this idea, and the caller really hit the nail on the head, is that it can appeal across the political spectrum because it's not necessarily one party's idea or another. It's that people are very powerful organisms, and they have a lot of good ideas if we can just activate them in the right way.
We have an email here from Steve in Stephenville. Steve writes, one comment, organisms do not intentionally do things in order to evolve or reproduce more than others. That's not how evolution works. Over time, some members of a variable population are better fitted to their environment, which gives them a better chance of survival and reproducing.
Yeah, so this is a really good point because I want to raise the idea that I'm not talking about just stamping on ideas from nature directly onto human affairs, because we have all sorts of ethical ideas, political ideas, as the last caller mentioned, that move into that realm and sort of filter these ideas. So just like when I'm doing environmental policy, I don't expect that the best science is going to translate directly into the best policy. It's got to go through all these filters. One of those filters when we're talking about applying biological ideas is that we won't tolerate ethically as humans just experimenting with things and seeing how many of us die in order to improve a system.
Let me jump in for a minute. We have to take a quick break, and you can finish your thought in just a couple of minutes. My guest is Rafe Sagarin. His new book is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst Rafe Sagarin, whose new book is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And Rafe, before the break, you were reminding us that in applying lessons from nature, we still have to recognize that there are obvious ethical limitations.
Yeah, and so everything goes through these kind of filters, and one of the advantages we have as humans is that we can be a little bit deliberate about how we shape our adaptability, and we can use our own adaptations that come out of having a complex mind and being a very social organism that's allowed us to develop technology to really have the best of both worlds if we allow it. So, for example, we can use networked cell phone technology to give us a lot of advance information about coming changes and coming threats. There are groups out there using cell phones which are widely available even in the most remote parts of the world to identify the first outbreaks of diseases that are jumping from animals to humans, which is often where people are still hunting wild game. So you can get reports of that early. So there are a lot of ways we can sort of bypass the problems of natural adaptability, which is that there's a lot of death and a lot of wastage by using our own clever minds.
How can our organizations benefit from learning like babies?
Well, essentially, babies are constantly exploring and identifying change in their world and developing this mindset through observation. It's one of the things that we in society are starting to fail at because we're spending less and less time exploring the complex world around us and spending more time in front of screens, which are, in the end, still binary, highly simplified representations of reality. Now, babies are in this completely new world full of all these new stimuli, and they're constantly testing and exploring and observing and trying to put things into patterns, which makes sense about the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I picked up a little ways into the discussion here, and I kind of was curious. I know the Internet now is really an amalgamation and evolution of various technologies, but my understanding of the initial layout that DARPA was doing back in the 60s was that they designed it to really design the network to be structured in a sense so that if you have point A connections between A, B, C, and D, and they're all interconnected, and you have, say, point A to point B, the connection fails, you can still connect from point A to B by circumventing by going from point A to D to C to B, and you can get around that way. And I was wondering if that sort of concept's really had, one, if it's seen anywhere in nature, and two, I mean, if you think that sort of concept is useful in our society today or in nature or various aspects.
Yeah, well, we see the same basic properties of computer networks. We see them everywhere in nature, in the relationships of different proteins in a yeast genome are related in a networked way. Social interactions, of course, are related in a networked way, which gives you some resilience to taking out individual nodes. We saw that the terrorists leading up to 9/11 had this loose network such that as it's a network that evolved. So as you got closer to the day of 9/11, it became more and more decentralized so that if any individual got taken out, they wouldn't connect to the other individuals such that in the end, most of those hijackers did not know one another. So networks have been exploited in all kinds of ways, but they also grant us a measure of security when they have that decentralized quality. Now, what I've understood from the development of the Internet from the initial DARPA plan to now is that it's actually gotten a lot of nodes that really kind of bottleneck us in the ISPs, and that's why you have countries like Syria that can actually shut down the entire Internet and social networks just by going that way. That was sort of an unexpected sort of commercial development of the Internet that's actually made us more vulnerable, from what I understand.
The kind of information that can be tracked on the Internet is really fascinating. And I wonder if you tell the story about Google, which, of course, is not a company with a health care mandate, but in fact has gotten quite good at predicting where the next big outbreaks of diseases like influenza will be.
Yeah, so this is a good example because Google Flu Trends, which I'll explain, comes out of a company that is built essentially from the ground up as an adaptable organism where, at least up until recently, managers at Google were required to spend 20% of their time doing something completely different from their day job. And this often led to creative partnerships among very different types of Googlers who developed products like Google Flu Trends. Now, what Google Flu Trends does is it uses this other adaptable power of Google, which is the fact that all of us are out there Googling something on our computer, and one of the things we're looking for at different times of the year is, does my kid have flu, or what are flu remedies? And Google looked at tracking flu-related terms that people are searching for, and what they showed is just by tracking those terms, you can see spikes and troughs in terms of when people are searching flu-related terms. Those correspond quite precisely to the flu reports that come out of the centralized Centers for Disease Control, with one major difference. You can get those Google Flu Trends almost instantly Whereas to get the flu trends from CDC, they've got to get surveys out to doctors and hospitals, back from doctors and hospitals, compile them, analyze them, write them up in a report. You get Google flu trends up to 2 weeks earlier for the same data, essentially. So it shows how powerful having multiple observers can be towards identifying a threat.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Ed on the line in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I like much of what Mr. Sagrin is saying, but I wouldn't want to give the top-down approach. Wouldn't want to completely dismiss it. It has given us our successes. I don't think we would have put a man on the moon by now if we completely were to ditch that approach. I could go on with other other successes. I think the key, perhaps, is that we need to provide nature with better PR consultants so that its successes, which I acknowledge are valuable, important, and valid, but we need to make them more better known so that people understand them and that creative people can share what they learn from these successes across fields.
What do you think, Rafe?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with the caller, Ed. It is definitely within what I'm talking about that you need some central control, some central body. Again, the octopus's skin cells aren't floating around in outer space. They're essentially working for this body, which is an octopus, and that central organization has a very important role. And I think it's a changing balance of what you see. So now, for example, you see the more decentralized, challenge-based approach giving us a new boost in terms of space technology, for example, where NASA's shuttle program was aging out. Then you develop like the SpaceX program and other challenges to really stimulate new thinking and new ways of problem solving. So it's about achieving some of that balance. And I couldn't agree more with the caller's point that nature needs a better PR because, in fact, one of the reasons that we've become less adaptable is, again, because we're spending less time appreciating the value of nature. And I even talk in the book in a chapter just about the security systems that are provided for us free of charge from nature when we leave them intact. Things like wetlands and mangroves, which we tend to ride roughshod over and then develop security challenges, like what happened in New Orleans when we got rid of some of the protective wetlands in front of New Orleans. And we do so at our own peril. So we've really got to also appreciate all the things that nature does for us absolutely free that protect us, and yet we don't pay the price immediately when we destroy those natural security systems.
So how open do you find that very hierarchical institutions like the U.S. military are to these kinds of ideas when you present them the way you have today?
Well, they're actually very open to them because people within those organizations, especially the ones like the young officers who have been fighting for the last 10 years over in Iraq and Afghanistan, hear these ideas. They're like, yeah, that's exactly what I was doing when I was overseas and trying to solve problems immediately. Now I come back here to the Pentagon and I need to figure out how I can continue to develop this adaptable capacity. Anytime when I've talked with practitioners, with police chiefs or fire chiefs, with first responders, with people who went over to Haiti after the earthquake there, they get it. They get the need to be adaptable. And what they're trying to figure out is, how do I spread this throughout my organization? How do I create this culture of adaptability within this organization? And what I'm hoping is that the book helps you do that. It gives you step by step, what are the key attributes you're looking for to create an adaptable system, even within an organization or a system that is entirely unadaptable right now.
So nature seems to understand or accept the idea that you can never remove entirely all the things that might threaten you. You just have to figure out how to avoid them enough to sort of survive and allow your descendants to survive. Why do we have such a hard time with that?
I think we have a hard time with it because we are a social organism that cares about our fellow humans far beyond our immediate relationships. So it's not just this idea of kin selection, how closely related our genes are. We help complete strangers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes us want to protect them, whether it's our close family or strangers. And we want to be able to say, and it's also political, that we want to be able to say, we can keep you safe. But the fact is, no matter what we do, there's always going to be more risk in the environment. So instead of deluding ourselves into the notion that with enough resources thrown at a problem, we can completely eliminate the source of that problem, let's say, how can we use resources more efficiently to solve the most pressing problems, to identify and then solve the most pressing problems.
There are also questions about actions motivated by what some of us might believe are irrational belief systems, but ultimately dwelling on that doesn't really solve anything.
It doesn't get us anywhere to say, oh, you know, those people are crazy over there for doing this. It's much more effective to say, why would they have that kind of behavior? What does that come from? And when we go through the whole complex ball of yarn of human behavior and trace it all the way back, it almost always turns out to be the same thing we see in all living organisms, whether you're talking about a salmon that is suicidally swimming upstream to get back to the exact stretch of stream where it was born, or whether it's viruses and bacteria fighting to retain control of their genome. All organisms need a way to identify themselves as opposed to something that's not like themselves. And that goes back to the earliest organisms, and it appears now in humans as complex behaviors that reinforce group identity, especially when that identity is formed against another. Mm-hmm. And we see it very trivially when we look at fans of college sports teams, Duke versus North Carolina, and the rivalries you guys to have down there in Texas. And we see it more seriously when we talk about suicide bombers and radicalized populations on all sides of a conflict. It's all about being able to identify who's in my group and who's not in my group.
So in order to combat that, it helps to understand what motivates the other side.
Yes, and it helps to understand what would be seen as value to that other side. Often, and this is stuff that an anthropologist, Scott Atran, has brought to my attention, often it's things that don't really matter that much to us that are incredibly important to another side. And Nelson Mandela recognized this brilliantly when he took power after apartheid in South Africa, and even his own party members wanted to destroy the South African Springbok rugby team. It was a symbol to them of white power and white domination.
I'm going to have to jump in. Maybe people can look this up for themselves. Rafe Sagarin's new book is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. Rafe, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, which you can find at kera.org/think. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion, email think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.